Hello there. We're glad to have you with us this morning, however you came about to be our way this morning. We are always happy to see the faces in the crowd, always encouraged to look at each other and to have a few moments that we can spend together to study God's Word. And especially as we're going through this series and discussing what it's like to just be in a world where we're exhausted, to be in a world where it wears us out, it brings us down. And sometimes we have these feelings and feel guilty for them, but as we've looked at the scriptures in this series, we realize some things that things like Jesus understand. God sees us. God gives us strength during these times. We've seen a lot of different things, and we want to take another look at some of this morning. One of the most intense phrases in the entirety of Scripture. God, just kill me. Can you imagine anyone saying that? Can you imagine anyone getting to a point in their life where they sit down and they look up to the heavens and they say, God, just kill me? How tired do you have to be of the things that are going on around you? How tired do you have to be of the work that you've been doing? How tired do you have to be of life itself to sit down under a tree and say, God, just kill me? And I don't know, you know, maybe wherever you're at this morning, maybe you've had a thought like this. Maybe you thought, you know what, this world has just brought me down to a point where I've said, God, I'm done with this world. I don't want to be in this world anymore. But maybe you haven't come to that extreme of a point. Maybe you've just said, I'm exhausted. I'm tired of this. I just don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to be in this place that I'm in anymore. I don't want to have these responsibilities that I have anymore. God, just take these things away from me. This phrase, God, just kill me, is so intense, not just because of the meaning behind the phrase, but because of who says it. We just read a moment ago this story. The words, God, just kill me, come out of the mouth of Elijah. This is the man who, when we get to the first century, and Jesus says, who do people say that I am? They say, well, some people think you're Elijah. They hold Elijah in such high regard in the first century that when they see Jesus doing the things that he's done, they say, this must be the second coming of Elijah. That's how highly they thought of this man who sits down under a tree and says, God, just kill me. Jesus himself compares John the Baptist, his forerunner, to this man Elijah. Jesus himself holds Elijah in high regard, the man who sits down under a tree and says, God, just kill me. God himself, when Jesus goes up on the Mount of Transfiguration, and he's prepared to go through the final part of his ministry, as he prepares himself to go to the cross, who does God send to comfort him? Moses and Elijah. God himself holds Elijah in such high regard that he uses him to comfort his own son, the man who sat down under a tree and said, God, just kill me. This is a man that when we think about him, we don't think about this point. We don't think about him in this kind of state. We think about him like the first century people thought about him. We think about him like Jesus thought about him. We think about him like God thinks about him. But there's a moment in Elijah's life that is more intense than any other moment he faces. How does he get to this point? How does this man who is held in such high regard by God the Father himself get to a point where he says, God, just kill me? Go back with me for just a minute to 1 Kings chapter 17. We won't spend just a ton of time there, but this is where the story begins. You'll remember just about a month ago, Jeremy got up and he preached an excellent sermon on 1 Kings 17. So we don't have to spend a ton of time there, but let's just kind of recap what happened in that lesson. And maybe let's put some of the viewpoint of Elijah on it very briefly so that we can understand what's happened to him up to this point. You remember that there's this evil king out there. This evil king who is turning people away from God constantly. He has led Israel into a place of complete rejection. This is no longer a land full of covenant worshipers of God. This is now a land full of heretics. That's all you're going to see around because their king has led them to the most evil point that they have ever been. And so God sends Elijah onto the scene. And as Elijah comes onto the scene, God says, there's not going to be rain for a long time. And so as they prepare for this drought, we come into 1 Kings chapter 17. And I imagine, I'm going to put some words into Elijah's mouth this morning. But I imagine that as we get into those first few verses, when God says, go away from here and turn eastward and hide yourself to the brook Cherith, and you will drink from the brook that I have commanded you, and the ravens will provide for you. Elijah lives there for that time period, and I imagine as he is there, in his mindset, we're going to call this, I am alone with God. How powerful of a time do you think this is in Elijah's life? He gets to spend time alone with God. During the time that the entire nation that is around him is suffering this incredible drought, they can't find water, they can't find food, Elijah is being cared for directly by the hand of God. How faith-building do you think this moment is for Elijah? How powerful of a demonstration of God's providence is this moment? As we come through the rest of that story that Jeremy preached about, what we're going to find is that Elijah passes on that faith, doesn't he? He takes the spark that he's been given during his time being alone with God, and he passes his faith on to this woman and to her son. And we continue to see through the end of that story that God demonstrated his power by providing now for Elijah, for this widow, and for her son. Even when we get to the end of that story, when the widow's son is killed, Elijah calls out to God in verse 20. He says, O Lord my God, have you also brought calamity to the widow with whom I am staying by causing her son to die? And so he stretched himself out upon the child three times and called to the Lord and said, O Lord my God, I pray you, let this child's life return to him. Look at verse 22. Then the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah. You've got a powerful statement of the relationship that these two have. The relationship where Elijah feels bold enough and confident enough to come before God and make a request, and God is comfortable enough in his relationship with Elijah that he does what Elijah asks. He doesn't require anything else of him. He doesn't make him go through some other trial. God listens to Elijah, raises the widow's son. We come down to that last moment in verse 23. When Elijah presents the son to his mother, he says, see, your son is alive. And in verse 24, she says, now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth. What a powerful statement. What kind of a vibe is coming off of Elijah at this point? That now people can see this is a man of God. He has been alone with God. He has been cared for by God personally to the point where when he calls and asks God for something, God picks up the phone and says, I'll do it. You are a powerful man of God. Elijah goes through this moment, and how do you think he feels in his relationship with God? Because he has spent time alone with God. But then as you come into 1 Kings chapter 18, the single most famous story about Elijah in the entire scripture. 1 Kings chapter 18, you come into this moment where Elijah is going to finally confront the one who has rebelled against God the most. The one who has been the most evil king of all time. And as Elijah comes into this moment, again, we're going to put some words into his mouth. But I think as Elijah goes to stand before Ahab and the prophets, he's going to make a shift from being alone with God to being alone for God. He stands in front of these people as God's prophet by himself. And again, you imagine maybe the strength and the power that he might feel in himself at this moment as the person who stands in front of these prophets of Baal. You've got the story that happens, and just to kind of give you a recap, just in case it's not fresh on your mind, Elijah shows up. And Ahab and Obadiah have gone different ways, trying to find some way to get some reprieve from the famine for their land. And Elijah runs into Obadiah and he says, I want you to tell your master that I'm coming today. And so Obadiah goes back, and eventually Elijah finds Ahab. As we get down just a little bit into 1 Kings chapter 18, look with me in verses 17 through 19 here. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is this you, O troubler of Israel?" And Elijah says, "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, because you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and you followed the Baals. Now then, send and gather me all Israel at Mount Carmel, with 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." Elijah comes to the most evil king who has ever been king, the one who has the most power in all of the land, and they swap insults. How powerful do you think Elijah is with his comeback? In his own mind, Ahab says, "Why are you here? This is your fault." Elijah says, No, this is your fault. You and your father's house and everyone who came before you, you led us to this point. And Elijah stands there boldly and he says, "I want you to bring all 850 of those men to me because I'm going to take them on by myself for God." Elijah's time alone with God has emboldened him to a moment where he can stand alone for God. As we get down into verse 22, this is why I don't think I'm putting too many words into Elijah's mouth, but as we get down into verse 22, he says, "I alone am left a prophet of the Lord. Baal's prophets are 450 men." That's how he opens up the challenge. And so, of course, you know how the challenge goes. They each get their own animal. They each build their own altar. And as they build the altar, Elijah says, "Whichever God comes down with fire is God." Now, think about where Elijah is in this moment. What is he expecting to happen? He spent time alone with God. He's witnessed the power of God. He's witnessed God provide. On the flip side of that, he knows that Baal is not God. He knows that Baal is just a piece of rock. Baal is not going to do anything. As Elijah stands there, he has the most confidence he's probably ever had standing alone for God. And here's what he expects. Elijah is expecting exactly what happens. When the prophets of Baal call out on their God and they ask for fire, nothing's going to happen. Elijah's expecting his God to answer. And what Elijah's expectation is that when my God answers with fire, all of the people of Israel will turn back to him. Everybody's going to turn back to this covenant. Everybody's going to come back into this relationship with God. Elijah is expecting reconciliation. And he's expecting to be the champion. He's expecting to lead people through the doors back to God. But as we come back to the story here for just a minute, we see this amazing moment where these men jump around for the entire day. And they do all sorts of crazy things. They dance, they cut themselves, they pour blood on this altar. They do whatever they can to get Baal to answer them with fire. And Elijah becomes even more emboldened to the point where he makes fun of him. He says, "Oh, you know what? Maybe he's gone on vacation. Call a little louder. Maybe he's asleep. He needs an alarm clock. Maybe he took a bathroom break. Maybe he'll be back in a few minutes." Elijah's feeling pretty bold at this point. And as I envision this scene and the way that I see it happening is eventually at the end of all of this, when Elijah has had enough, you have the sun in the sky. In my mind, it's getting a little bit darker and he's just tired. He's ready to be done for the day. And so they've been dancing around and hopping around and calling out and crying out and singing and cutting themselves and whatever else it is. And finally, I see Elijah just standing up and saying, "Stop. He's not going to answer. He's not coming. Bring me my animal." You can feel the power in his words. As they bring the animal to him, they put it on the altar. And Elijah says, "I don't just want the animal." He says, "I want you to cover this with water." And then he says, "I want you to do it again. I want you to do it again." They dug a trench around the altar so much so that this offering is dripping wet with water to the point that this trench is filled up with water. And all Elijah has to do is call on his God. You look at verses 36 and following, you're going to see Elijah simply ask God to demonstrate his power. Elijah, in his boldness, in his confidence, stands alone before 850 other prophets and calls on his God. as we come down to the end of this chapter. In verse 41, Elijah says to Ahab, after God answers with fire, Elijah says to Ahab, go up and eat and drink, because I think I hear the sound of rain. It hasn't rained for years. They've been waiting on this drought to end. And this is Elijah's triumphant moment, right? Like, this is what he's been waiting for. All right, we can bring the rain back in. God's going to come back into this nation. The people are going to turn back to God. Ahab's going to be a great king again. So Ahab goes up to eat and drink. Elijah goes up to Carmel. He crouches down. He puts his face between his knees. And he asks his servant to go up seven times to see whether or not anything's coming. And on the seventh time, the servant comes back and he says, I see a little cloud off in the distance. And Elijah knows God is still there. How powerful of a moment. How powerful does this relationship between God and Elijah look at this time? How much great work has Elijah done up to this point, where he's built his faith in God by being alone with God, passed on his faith to two other people through the widow and her son, and now demonstrated his faith by standing alone for God in front of 850 prophets of Baal. Elijah's expecting great national reconciliation, and he's put himself on the line for it. He's given his life for this reconciliation. And he's seen God's power countless times. Throughout just these two chapters, we have as many miracles as any other prophet witnesses. And then as we come to the climax of the story, as we get to Elijah's triumphant moment where he is ready to walk through the gates of heaven and bring the nation of Israel along with him, nothing changes. The people don't come back. They don't change their ways. Ahab doesn't become a good king. Jezebel doesn't become a good queen. Things don't go the way Elijah's expecting here. All this hard work, all of these difficult things that he's done, he's put himself on the line for God, and it doesn't happen. The great revival that he wants does not occur. In Elijah's mind, he's a failure. And we see that as we come into the story that we read a moment ago. Once Ahab tells Jezebel all that Elijah has done, how he killed all the prophets with the sword, Jezebel sends a messenger to Elijah. He says, so may the gods do to me and even more if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow at this time. Instead of being the bold and confident man that we've met for the last two chapters, instead of being the man who built his relationship, his faith, and his trust in God while he spent time alone with God, having God care for him personally, instead of being the man who faced off against 850 people by himself, it says he was afraid. He rose and he ran for his life. He came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there. He himself went to Jay's journey into the wilderness. He came down and he sat under a juniper tree. And he requested for himself that he might die. And he said, it is enough now, O Lord, take my life. I am no better than any of my fathers. Elijah says, I failed. You put me here to make this great reconciliation. You put me here to do your work, to bring the people back to you. And Ahab's just as evil as he was before. And Jezebel's just as evil as she was before. They're not coming back to you, God. He says, I'm no better than any of the other prophets who came before me. He says, God, just kill me. I would rather die than have to face this. We go from Elijah being alone with God, Elijah being alone for God, and now I'm just alone. Elijah feels like he's by himself. And you see that as we go down through the rest of this story. He lays down and he sleeps. And I imagine I could be wrong. Again, this is me just trying to read through how Elijah's emotions are coming through this story. But as he lays down, he asks God, he says, God, just kill me. And he lays down to sleep. I think Elijah's not expecting to wake up, because God's been listening to him every time he's asked him for something, right? Every time Elijah says, God, please do this, God does it. And so here he sits under this tree as a failure in his own mind, and he says, God, just kill me, and he lays down to sleep. expecting to die. But God won't let him. When he wakes up, there's an angel touching him. He says, get up and eat. I don't know what's happening in Elijah's mind at this point. My guess is, if I'm correct in thinking that he expected he was going to die, he might have thought he was dead. When he wakes up and there's an angel with him and says, I want you to eat, he might be thinking, that was it. We did it. But the angel says, go over to where you were and pick up this food. And he finds a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. So he eats and he drinks and he lays down again. The angel of the Lord comes a second time and he says, arise and eat because the journey is too great for you. So he eats and he drinks some more and he goes for 40 days and 40 nights to the mountain of God. This next verse, I think, encapsulates the relationship. Elijah goes to a cave and he makes a home there. The word of the Lord comes to him and he says, what are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here? This is not a question of location. This is not a question of, why are you in this cave? This is not a question of, why are you at Mount Horeb? This is not a question of, why are you in the region you're in? God says, what are you doing here? As a question of, how did you get to this point? And notice, God doesn't just come down and condemn him. God doesn't come down and say, get up, stop feeling sorry for yourself. You don't deserve to feel like this. Look at what all we've done. God doesn't do any of that. He asks him to reflect. What are you doing here? Elijah says, I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel. They've forsaken your covenant. They've torn down your altars. They've killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left. That's it. I'm alone. There's nobody else. I am the only one in all of Israel who is going to follow you, God. Elijah has put himself in his own mind. He has put himself on an island for God. And when he's done that, he has carried the entire weight of Israel's covenant, the entire weight of the relationship between God and all of the people of Israel. Elijah's put it on his shoulders. He says, because the people didn't come back to you like I was expecting them to, because I didn't lead them through like the champion that I should have, I'm alone. And in this moment, in this cave, God comes to him and he says, what are you doing here? Elijah is feeling the pressure of the world around him. He is feeling the pressure of all of the sins of Israel. And he's feeling the pressure of the work that he has put into bringing the nation out of those sins and nobody doing anything. Elijah says, I am alone. There are so many different things that we could pull out of this story. And as I tried to craft this lesson this week, I started off with about 50 different points. But I want to take us through the rest of the story, and then I want us to just take one home today. Look with me first at what God says here. First of all, he says, I want you to go stand on the mountain before the Lord. Behold, the Lord is passing by. There was a great strong wind. It tore up the mountains. It broke the pieces of the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, there was a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of gentle blowing. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and he went out and he stood in the entrance of the cave. And behold, a still small voice came to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? God, in this moment, gives him the most incredible imagery that anybody has ever been given. This is the best illustration that God can make. You see, Elijah was expecting God to do these amazing, incredible, huge things and lead the entire country back to himself. And when it didn't happen, Elijah just assumed, we failed. That's it. If I can't do it, nobody can because I'm alone. God shows him through an illustration. There's a great earthquake. There's a huge wind. The rocks are going to split in two. All of these incredible things that you expect God to be in, and he's not in a one of them. God comes in a still, small voice, asking him the same question. Be reflective. And we could spend time on this point, because this is, I think if we're to look at what God is showing Elijah here, we could look on ourselves and see, okay, when we talk to God and we are expecting something from God, we expect huge things, don't we? We expect God to appear in massive ways, but often when we are looking for him in those big ways, we miss him where? In the little ways. God says, Elijah, you were looking for me in these big, big things. You were expecting this monstrous thing to happen, but you don't understand, you're just a little part of this. You're just one piece of the puzzle in my overall plan. And we could spend our time on that, but look here at the rest of this story. God says, what are you doing here, Elijah? And Elijah, he doesn't seem to get the point. He says exactly what he said before. He says, I was very zealous for the Lord. The sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant. They've torn down your altars. They've killed your prophets with the sword. And I am alone, and they seek to take my life. God doesn't condemn him for his thoughts. God doesn't say, you're wrong for this. God doesn't say, get your sorry self up. You don't have any reason to be feeling like this. God just says, okay, let me show you what you're missing. We come down through the rest of this passage. The Lord said to him, go return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram. And Jehu the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel. And Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint prophet in your place. It shall come about, one who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu, shall be put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha, shall put to death. So pause here for just a minute. God says, this wasn't all I had in mind. God says, I wasn't hanging my entire hope for the reconciliation of the nation of Israel on you. He says, you were a good piece of the puzzle, but I got a lot more in mind. And now look at this. God says, I have left 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. Elijah says, I am alone. And God, through his illustration and God, through his words, says, you have never been alone, Elijah. He says, I've never hung this on you by yourself. I never expected you to carry this burden, this weight on your shoulders. Matter of fact, step back with me for just a minute to Elijah's meeting with Obadiah. Ahab calls Obadiah in verse 3 of 1 Kings chapter 18, and he says, Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. When Jezebel destroyed the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets, and he hid them by 50s in a cave, and he provided them bread and water. Elijah's met this guy, the guy who put people away for God, the guy who hid them for God. Elijah's met him, and so he knows this. He knows there are other people who are there to help reconcile the nation to God, and yet what does he do? He carries the weight on his shoulder. God says, you are not alone, and you've never been alone. I've got 7,000 people that you can turn to and ask for help. I borrowed this quote from a preacher friend. He said, when we isolate ourselves in our own faith, we forget that God's plan is bigger than one person. When we focus on ourselves and our burden and the weight that's on my shoulders and the things that affect me, and we don't share that burden with other people, we don't share that with the people that God has reserved for us, that weight comes crumbling quickly. That weight brings us to our own juniper tree. That weight brings us to a point where we cry out to God and say, God, I can't bear this anymore. Because guess what's going to happen? We're going to fail. We're going to mess up. And when we don't, when we isolate ourselves and when we put ourselves on that island and when we sin, we are going to feel the entire weight of our relationship with God crumble around us. What we need to realize today, and this is the point I want us to take home from this whole lesson, of the 100 things we could get out of this one story, God has reserved a people for us. When you look at your life, when I look at my life, and we see the things that we struggle with, when we see our faith, when we see ourselves in our walk with God, when we look out around us and we see the sin of the world, when we see things getting worse on a daily basis, if all we do is curl up in a hole in our room and do nothing with that, it's going to bring us to the same point that Elijah got to. It's going to bring us to our own juniper tree. God says, I reserved 7,000 people for you, Elijah. I reserved 7,000 people that you can turn to and help you with your work for God. As we look at our lives today and where we're at, as we are doing our work for God, God has never intended for any one of us to carry our own burdens. Galatians chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. If anyone is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, each one of you looking to yourself so that you too will not be tempted. Bear one another's burdens and thereby fulfill the law of Christ. This is what God intends. The law of Christ, the purpose of the church, is so that we can bear one another's burdens. So that we don't have to end up under a juniper tree by ourselves crying out to God. So that we can come to a place like this and have 200 and something other people who can share the load with us. Matter of fact, when we turn to Hebrews chapter 10, the passage that we're all familiar with about not forsaking the assembling of the saints, that's what we use in Hebrews 10:25. You got to be at church on Sunday because Hebrews 10:25 tells you. Why does he say we need to be at church on Sunday? Why does he say we need to assemble together? Now, hear me on this. It's not to worship God. That's not what he says. Now, we come here and we worship God by virtue of being here because that's what we do. But God does not need our worship. He wants it. He desires it. He covets it. But if we don't worship God, who's still God? It's God. We come here for the purpose of worship, but Paul says in Hebrews, you come here, you assemble together to encourage one another, to stimulate one another, to love and good deeds. And he says, encourage one another all the more as you see the day drawing near. We assemble as a church. The church exists for so many reasons, but one of the reasons that we assemble and exist is because God knew each and every one of us needed the other. God knew each and every one of us could not handle this life on our own. We come into the book of James, and as we read in James chapter 5 here, in James chapter 5, he says, is there anyone among you suffering? Well, sorry. You got to handle that on your own. No, that's not what James says. James says, is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? He's to sing praises. Is anyone among you sick? Well, good luck with that. You got problems. So do we all. Enjoy yours. That's not what James says. James says, if anyone among you is sick, let him call for the elders of the church. And they are to pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. Prayer offered in faith will restore the one who is sick, and the Lord will raise him up. If he has committed sins, they will be forgiven him. Therefore, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another so that you may be healed. You don't have to handle your burden on your own. You don't work for God by yourself. I don't work for God by myself. And I don't think there's a better example of that in this church than when we stood here last week with some 30, 40 some odd men who are all standing here ready to help you. Ready to help you grow in your walk with Christ. Ready to help you in your work for God. Each and every one of those men who was called up here to the front last week is waiting to help you. You don't have to carry that burden alone. You don't have to end up under a juniper tree. Each and every person in this room is here because we are ready to help each other. Look with me one more time at 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Until studying for this lesson, I know I've read this passage before, but until studying for this yesterday, I don't think I had really grasped this passage. Maybe I still don't really grasp it, but there was just something that stuck out to me that had never stuck out to me before. In 1 Thessalonians 5, beginning of verse 11, he says, "Therefore, encourage one another and build up one another just as you are also doing." First of all, he says exactly what these other passages are saying, right? Encourage each other, build each other up. That's why the church is here. "But we request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and who have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Live in peace with one another." Listen to what Paul says here. If you see somebody doing work for God, if you see them doing great things for God, don't let them do it alone. Go out there and tell them you appreciate what they're doing. How many times have you gone to someone? How many times have I gone to someone and said, "You know what? You're a great Christian. I appreciate the work that you have put in for the church at Dalreda. I appreciate the work that you have put in for the church that Christ built." How many times have we done that? But Paul says, if you see someone working for God, you commend them for that. He says, don't let them do it on their own. You got to carry that burden along with them. Because if people carry the burden alone, they end up under the juniper tree. And that's what he comes to in verse 14. "We urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with everyone." Help the weak. There are going to be people we see out there who are doing great work for God by themselves. Paul says, commend those people. Help those people. But then he says, you're going to see the people who are under the juniper tree. And those are the people God is calling the church to go help. To reach out a hand to and say, get up and eat. You've got work to do. Get up and eat. This burden is on all of us. It's not up to you to reconcile everybody to God. It's up to all of us to effect a change in the world for God. The burden rests on all of our shoulders, not one individual. God never intended us to be isolated. And he has never, not once, left us alone. So this morning, what are you doing here? I'm not asking why you're in Montgomery. I'm not asking why you're in a church building. I'm not asking why you're at Dalreda. How did you get to this point? What are you doing here? Are you here this morning trying to make it on your own? Don't. Because if you do, you end up under the juniper tree. Are you here this morning because you're at the end of your rope? Because you are under the tree? Because you are saying, God, I'm just done with this. I don't know what else to do. We're here to bear that burden with you. Are you here this morning because you need encouragement? All you got to do is ask. That's why the church is here. Maybe you're here this morning to encourage others. Maybe you're here this morning to help bear each other's burdens. We appreciate it. We commend you for that. And we want to help you with that. Make it known to us. How can we help you in your work for Christ? Are you here this morning to connect to Christ and never be alone again? We have an opportunity to do that this morning. Through faith, repentance, confession, and baptism, you can be in a relationship with Christ. You can be a part of the church that bears each other's burdens. You can be off that island, and instead of being by yourself, you can be with a group of people working for the same purpose. A group of people working for Christ. What are you doing here this morning? If there is something that we can help you with, won't you come as we stand and sing?
Jesus, Jesus.